The order and this morning were Oregon Department of Transportation public hearing, and we're dealing with zero-based budget review, central services. Mike Marsh is here with us again.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your time. A little refresher going back to where we left off. We were reviewing, going through the appendages off of this sheet. We started last week with the legal obligations, critical needs, fixed costs, and we were halfway through the packages. And the form you should be looking at right now would be this one. Looks like this. And we're on package number 4, which would be on the second page at the bottom. The members have tracked that down. It looks good. We're on package 4. We've just gotten into financial services, the one labeled FS, third from the bottom there. And I'll continue into that, but did want to refresh your memory also about the concept of zero-based budgeting, remembering that we're building from the bottom. We've gone through the legal packages. We've gone through the critical packages towards the bottom of the build. Everything we're talking about today are things that are already in the budget. They are not new positions. So as I go through and discuss, this restores this, this adds this, I want to make sure the context is clear that we're not adding positions. We're actually adding back from zero, but these are all within the current service level of the Department of Transportation budget. In other words, positions that currently exist. Mr. Chair, looking at the financial services package there, the first one deals with financial coordinators, and what's happening there is restoring the what we call a consolidated help desk approach at financial services, meaning when customer divisions have concerns and need to work through financial issues, this would be a place to call to get their financial issues addressed. We aren't fully restoring all the financial coordination that we're at the level now, but we would restore enough to have divisions and regions have someone located at their site that knows their business and can anticipate financial information needs. The second piece of that financial coordination is forecasting and dealing with the functions of estimation of what our revenues will be. As we look at that function, we've got one FTE that's involved at this level, which restores reporting and economic analysis and allows us to determine what those revenues will be. The next one is the restoring of one internal auditor position, which will allow for audit and review functions to operate at the current service level. So that restores us to the level at which we currently exist, allowing for internal audit functions that are required both by the federal government as well as transfers internally. The restoration of electronic data processing, which is the EDP, and performance auditor positions relate to specialty areas of internal audit where we're trying to address certain areas where we feel like there's greatest risk. Right now, of course, Y2K is a piece of that, but with all the transfers of information and data between the Department of Transportation, cities, counties, and the federal government, we feel the electronic data processing function is a critical area that needs an audit function. Moving into the HR or human resources area within package 4, the first area there is the program support.
Representative Butler.
Can I just ask a brief question regarding the financial services portion of package 4? You talk about the cities and counties. Is that maintaining their level of support? Is that the IRIS program? Is that what that's called?
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, we have several different connections with cities and counties, most of which are not they're not electronic data processing. They're sending checks out. So we don't have an electronic connection directly. What we have an electronic connection with is the state treasury. So if you're talking about a computer program, then that connection is with treasury.
That's a financial function as opposed to any of the database for hard information.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
The human resources area, that first component is program support, which relates to central work to coordinate special projects, programs, and responses to external customers. And an example of that is the salary adjustment funding process, where negotiations occur centrally within the state to establish a salary adjustment rate. and then each agency must go through and do calculations about how that salary adjustment relates to their own agency and determine what the impact will be on their own agency. So that's a piece of the program support area.
Mike, is this the work where it says work environment training? If you recall, one of the senators from Marion County was somewhat agitated over some training session that was conducted on the part of ODOT employees.
Yes, Mr. Chair. There was a program in the 94 to 96 and even 1997 time frame that was called a team development training. And in that phase of training, there was a lot of analysis and training relating to how people can work best together. Under the scenario at the time, it seemed like a logical thing to do. I think most of the leadership now at ODOT was not there at the time to be able to comment directly about it, but suffice to say that form of training is no longer done. We've moved on to actually what the next item is talking about, work situation training. This is focused directly on work-related issues. It's not talking about some of the attitude issues, behavioral issues that were emphasized before. I think there is value to that kind of training, but the issue is when you have limited dollars, where is your best return on investment? Our training program is focused on what the individual employees need and can use immediately. And that's what we've got here is when it's work-related situational training that clearly relates directly to what we're doing. It's not the kind of, there were some horror story examples I won't recount, but those things are not being done.
Okay. Would it be possible to help develop a comprehensive budget note or narration or something that would go into the budget? Identifying that is a thing of the past and that we have developed new criteria for employee training now, and because I'm sure it's going to be one of the hammers that we always hear on the floor of the Senate, I'd rather be prepared to deal with it and say it's already been addressed.
Mr. Chair, yes, we have in one of our answers to questions from a prior session information about what we're doing in regard to that kind of training, and we'd be happy to develop from that a short piece that could become a budget note if the chair wishes.
That's fine.
Kind of budget narrative.
Yeah, the budget narrative rather than the budget
note. Okay, great.
We won't make it difficult for you, but I want to be able to respond to some of the critics if they raise the issue that we've dealt with it in the committee.
Be happy to do that. Appreciate the question.
Okay. Are there any questions by committee members? If not, if you'd move ahead, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just to summarize on the rest of that training that's shown there, those relate to reducing training costs through contracting on a large scale, the kinds of training that relates to major software changes, to apply the training immediately when software changes occur, to make sure we're tailoring the training to ODOT specific needs and concerns that employees relate to on the job. We talked about core curriculum the other day, which is the basic training for managers. We want to make sure that each employee gets that as part of the statewide curriculum to ensure that they all receive that. That's what the remainder of the training listed in this package is. And I'll move the information systems within this package if there's no other questions. The mainframe data center relates to the ability to meet scheduled equipment replacement cycles in the data center, including disk storage and tape management devices. We'll be able to decrease the equipment failures and resulting mainframe downtime by the addition of this package. And it increases the service levels at DMV and motor carriers to the current level of 99% availability, which is what we feel is necessary to meet customer demands there, especially in DMV. The last area within this package are the support services areas, the General Files and History Center, which restores the master repository for contracts, agreements, etc. There are a lot of questions that come in from Department of Justice, agencies, and the public about these files, and this restores it to an efficiently running operation that can be handled centrally. And the last piece is the purchasing and systems development, which allows us to have or brings back development of a purchasing management system to improve the efficiency of our purchasing system.
Mike, could I ask you, the purchasing system development, would that get at the so-called cost accounting issues?
Mr. Chair, the cost accounting is coming up shortly. We had one component of it in a prior package. The next component will be next. This one does not get at that.
This is not get at that?
No. This is the purchasing process directly to make sure that we have good centralized purchasing.
When you have a purchasing system development, does it relate to supplies that are purchased?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So if you buy sand and gravel or lava rock that's all crushed up for sanding material, that would be identified through this purchasing section.
What this purchasing group is doing is trying to make sure that we're meeting the answer is yes. What we're trying to do is make sure that the purchasing practices that we have here meet the requirements of ORS 279 and others, and to make sure that we're using good competitive processes and running it as efficiently as we can. So the answer is yes.
Okay. All right.
Moving on then to Package 5. The first portion of Package 5, Mr. Chair, relates to the communications area that CB, there's communications branch. Public information that's being addressed are restoring public information representatives in Regions 3 and 4, which are Eastern and Southern Oregon. They are there to ensure timely and pertinent information going to citizens of the public, media regarding emergencies, current and planned projects, as well as public involvement with local government officials and businesses and educators as we work through various public approaches. The second area there relates to support for the director's office in terms of scheduling, drafting correspondence, and record keeping, as well as public information dealing with things such as the travel information program that provides free weather and road conditions and alternative routes during emergencies. The last component is, or the third is the strategic communication area, which prints the state highway map, does responses to public inquiries, our toll-free telephone line, and information related to that toll-free telephone line. And the fourth component is the Safe Haven program. This is a subject unto itself in terms of time, but I'll just try to be brief. It's an opportunity for employees to call in on a confidential line and give confidential feedback about concerns, whether it's ethical concerns or other concerns. We feel like in an organization of our size, dealing with the kinds of purchasing issues that we have and the amount of assets that we have, it's useful to have this opportunity, in essence, whistleblower line to get information about concerns that employees may have. And it's something that's done pretty much on a national basis when you have as much assets as we have at Department of Transportation. The last area there is membership in the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, which is our association that relates to transportation issues and allows us to vote on technical standards, policies that influence the U.S. Department of Transportation, and gives us a chance to have input about the policies that come out from that organization. The second area is the financial services area within Package 5.
Yes, Representative Schrader.
This is trying to relate the FTE to the dollar amount there.
Mr. Chair, in terms of the FTE involved with each one of those, I'll hit that briefly. The two public information representatives had two FTE. The support for the director and public information communication is 1.78 FTE. And the remainder of that package is all related to services and supplies with no FTE.
Mike, let me try to amplify the representative's question. What we're having a hard time looking at is the FTE, say like 4.25 FTE on special recruiting, it shows that $687,900. It doesn't match out with just below 5 FTE, $1,904,000. Now, why does it cost $1,300,000 for one position, or 3/4 time position versus 4.25, and I think that's what the representative is for. It doesn't mesh out your numbers, FTE and dollar-wise.
Mr. Chair and Representative Strader, each one of these has a different weighting. The example the Chair just gave of the 5 FTE in the ISB area there, which is Information Systems Branch, a lot of our costs are related to the computer systems themselves, so the 1.9, I can hit that in just a moment, that separates those out. In the case of human resources, the 4.25 is mainly personnel costs, although there are other costs involved there. The more that it's related strictly to our employee costs, the lower it would be. In these cases, we have a lot of services, supplies, and contract costs that increase that significantly. So
let me ask you another question. How many other lines would this budget figure show up in? In other words, it's identified as special recruiting and human resources. Would it apply as special recruiting in central services somewhere else?
Mr. Chair, no. This would be the spot where that's located. And if I was to hit right now, for instance, the areas within that human resources area, it involves special recruiting function, which is one FTE, about $100,000, $106,000. The counseling piece is 0.25 FTE, about $20,000, and that's dealing with employee assistance and benefits information. Attorney General is no FTE. That's about $180,000, though. It deals with advice that the Attorney General gives us relating to personnel-related issues, which does save us money in the long run when we work through their advice. The annual report for the status of the safety program, which is a piece of HR, is 0.25 FTE and about $22,000. Each one of those pieces has a relatively small amount of services and supplies compared to the next category, which the Chair had referenced, ISB, where we have desktop project management, which by itself is only 3 FTE, but $650,000, because what we're talking about here is returning customer consulting for new purchases. We're ensuring purchase of the appropriate equipment, and we're actually doing purchase of equipment within that category.
Representative Butler, I have a question relative to the human resources package there. One FTE is responsible for the human or the employee assistance and benefits explanation. Is that not part of the responsibility and part of what was brought into the PERF system for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yes, PERF does have a line where you can call to get some information. What this is talking about though, is it is PERF, but it allows for an internal person that can, and it's not a full FTE, but it's 0.25 FTE. It's part of a person's job to be able to answer questions about all sorts of benefits as it relates to insurances, PERF issues, the other long-term disability, other issues that employees would have, so we have an internal resource to respond at least part-time to 4,800 people's questions internally.
But the PER, follow up, Mr. Chair,
yes.
But the PERS benefits portion can certainly be shifted over to the PERS internal number.
If I can respond, if I was an employee, no doubt, and I want to know information about PERS, I would not call ODOT. I'd, in essence, call directly on the 1-800 line to PERS, and they would speak to me on my benefits. What Mr. Marsh is talking about is, say I have a difficulty in getting my Blue Cross carrier or somebody else.
All other benefits.
It's all other benefits. It's not PERS. Is that
the only thing that relates to PERS, Mr. Chair, is when they do have to fill out forms when they join that relate to the public employee retirement system. There'd be a question about those forms that would be appropriate to be answered on site. And people, as they get close to retirement, may get an answer from PERS that they are unsure about, that they might want to balance with the individual. But most of the time, it's focused on other benefits, yes. And, Mr. Chair, continuing on with information systems, just to make a couple other points there, and hopefully that will answer the representative's question. We're also talking about information systems project reviews, which means, and we talked with Representative Schrader earlier about this issue of making sure that we review centrally within the Department of Transportation requests for information system assets, so that if one division is seeking a certain level of service through information systems assets. We don't have a level that's way up here with the latest bells and whistles, and over here we have a level that's not even meeting basic needs. We're trying to, within the limited resources we have, get the pieces of equipment that make the most sense and have the best return on investment. So that's the purpose of this review occurring there.
If I can, Mike, when it was directed by the House and Senate leadership that we consider doing zero-based budgeting, part of at least my frustration is if a Senate member asks me on the floor today, what are you looking at, like package five here, public information, if I showed 3.78 FTE, 1,110,000, I wouldn't be able to identify questions that somebody may explore with me on the floor of the Senate. Part of my frustration, I'll be real candid with you, is not knowing so much about how many FTE and how much lump sum it is, but trying to break down a little bit more specifically some of the actual costs and effect relationship to the position. If you recall, we talked about making 50,000 increments. Because when we get to work session, quite frankly, unless the committee members understand it and can go out on the floor of the Senate or the House and answer questions posed to them, we're probably not going to get a transportation package out of this committee unless the committees understand the basic concepts. And just going out to the floor of the Senate and saying, well, trust me, 3.78 FTE, $1,110,000. That doesn't mean anything to the average legislator. And so I'm not trying to be critical, but I'm saying, I guess we need to explore with you some better sides of information, getting it down so we can respond to some of our colleagues, because they're going to be shooting it up like fish in a barrel. And unless we have the information, it's going to be hard to communicate that information.
Mr. Chair, I hear what you're saying. In terms of going through that package, the communications package, that was the safe haven piece, the National Association piece, the two public information representatives, and the support for the director. I'd be happy to put something in writing that discusses what I just went through, that does show the FTE relationship to each one of those. I've been speaking to them, but maybe it'd be better to, after thinking through it, to give actual copies of the material so the members, if they're hearing something on the floor, wouldn't have to be taking so many notes today, but we can get you more detail about it actually in writing, if that would be helpful.
Well, I just want it so members of this committee can understand it, because we sure as heck can't explain it to our colleagues if we don't understand it. And there's going to be questions posed to us by some of our colleagues, we know that, who are going to say, well, what about this portion of the budget? I thought you zero-based this budget down. And if we show a lump sum of FTE and a lump sum of money, they're going to say, well, how do you know it's going for that position? How do you know it's actually being allocated for that position? Are we supposed to assume that every position is being identified and funded in a lump sum somewhere? And that's following up on Representative Schrader's question. I think it's kind of like putting your arms around a moving target, Mike, and I'll be real. Whoever gets identified as carrying the bill on the Senator or House side need to have access to this information so we can respond to questions.
I'd be happy to, everything that I'm speaking to today, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to get that in writing so that you not only have the summary information, but the detail, and any member that was carrying it would have that, or we can answer some more questions.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Moving on in package five, then, I was just on the information system branch piece there to discuss those components. And we're talking about the information systems project review process, where we make sure that with two FTE and $730,000, there's a review of all information systems projects within the department. We make sure there's an ability to have an enterprise-wide view of all information systems projects, and as I mentioned, ensure we don't have bells and whistles in one area when another area is not getting their basic needs met. The next component of that information systems area is information systems project support, which has zero FTE but about $515,000, which restores the internal contract administration, allows for time tracking, invoicing, asset management, all the pieces that allow us to do that contract administration with contractors who do a lot of the work that we don't have done with employees, remembering that we're trying to achieve through the decision packages in our budget about a 50% level of employee versus contractor support. So we have a significant amount of contractor work that occurs within the information systems area. The last component of Package 5, Mr. Chair, was the electronic forms design area. We do have a lot of forms we work with. We found it to be efficient to have one forms designer that works with that subject and allows us to develop and maintain the internal forms as well as printing coordination of projects such as the SIP itself, the Oregon Highway Plan, all the different kinds of plans that are done to ensure that these products are produced in the most efficient way, and that's that one position. And the last piece is the Library and Information Center, which again allows us access to the National Library System, gives us the ability to reduce subscription costs, if I can say it, through consolidated information, and really an access point for all the engineering work as well as other needs of the department in terms of research work that's done. And that is 2 FTE and $190,000 involved in that function. Mr. Chair, that's Package 5, and as I mentioned earlier, I will put into writing what I'm discussing in detail here so that members have more than the summary information that's included. Package 6.
Here, Mr. Wilker.
Representative Sager.
How would you classify Package 5? What would be the overall?
I would call Package 5, Mr. Chair, Representative Sager, customer-required items. And I think what we're going into now are customer service items that are requested and make sense, but are not at the required level. Things that we think make sense, but are not the absolutely required pieces. The first,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Yee.
I have a very basic question.
No, sorry.
I want to know, when we do zero-based budget, I'm looking at page one. Do we start with 49.85% critical needs, 12.01% legal obligation, 6 plus 8.25%. So the basic part of the budget is 70%, and we are only looking at 30% of the budget, which is optional. Is this what we are doing?
Well, let me try to find what sheet you're working out, though.
Page one.
Okay, we're working off
of the options, but so we are not starting from zero. We're just starting from 70% level. Is it?
No, Deb, would you respond to that question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Yee. We started with the first level of legal obligations, and we've already reviewed that part. That's the first 11%, and we've reviewed
12%.
Legal obligations is a total of
10.98%
of the total budget. And then the critical needs, we took us up to the
56.5%,
and we've reviewed the
7.96%
cost, and then we started in on the packages. We've already gone through those packages.
Oh, we've gone through the critical needs and the fixed costs.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And we decided they are...
We've made no decisions.
Oh, uh-huh.
We're just getting over you.
Okay. We haven't decided whether they are in fact critical or whether in fact they are legal obligations.
This committee has
We haven't done that yet.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So I know where we are.
That's fine. This month.
Mr. Chair, continuing on the beginning of Package 6, the first item there is the communication area that deals with anticipated needing public information programs. An example is what we handed out earlier. This is the kind of thing we want to try to anticipate when there's construction in the summer season. We handed this copy out to the members earlier, that type of communication, as well as in the case of DMV, when there were problems with the wait times, this employee actually worked through with others to, not employ these groups of employees, worked with DMV folks to establish a way to communicate to the public about best times to go to DMV to get their work done, and the fact that you want to try to do it through the mail. So they actually used screens off of movies. They rented some time at movie theaters to communicate to employees, to the public, that certain times are better than other times to go to DMV, and that helps by giving that information. It gave resulted in a reduction in the wait times at DMV. Another example is working through weekly newspaper information so that people know about, the public knows about what's going on with construction sites, and we aren't surprising them with what's occurring with the construction plans.
Did
Senator Duke.
At the movie theater?
Mr. Chair, correct. Senator Duke.
How do you do that? I'm assuming you don't have a person. Is there a videotaped message?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, next time you go to the theater, check out as you're waiting for the movie and review of future attractions coming on. There's slides that are not moving, but just a slide that goes on the screen. And sometimes there's something that relates to public information. Just some interesting to know things. And one of the things they put up was that certain times are better than others to go to DMV for getting your work done. Such as don't go on Mondays or Fridays. Certain times a day, which are better to go. And by getting that to the public, it results in people seeing that it's better to go at a certain time of day than another if you don't want to wait in line.
Is that less expensive than radio and newspaper, or did we determine it reaches a different audience?
Sharon Center, do they determine it needs a different audience? And I believe it is relatively cheap. Actually, I guess people put things like spouses' birthdays and things on that too, but as far as public information, it's a relatively cheap way to reach the public. I'm not sure what the DMV is.
So do you choose certain areas of the state to do that, or just kind of do it? You're doing it sort of statewide?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kutub, I believe it was done on a statewide basis, but I can get the details on that for
those that go to the movies. I saw one here in Salem. I saw a couple of metros, so so far it's been charged. Give them a break and show the orange diamond.
I go to the wrong movie. I still go to the Disney movie with my
child. Oh, I thought you were going to say that.
They probably show them at the Disney movie.
I thought you were going to say that exactly. You open yourself up.
We want to evaluate who's seeing what movie.
Yeah, here we go. All right.
Thank you. The first package under communications, and on to the next one, is financial services, which relates to restoring financial information reporting. And there, Mr. Chair, we're looking for employees that can be in the field, and they can free up the employees in the field who are doing other work by having our reports run by the employees that are most involved in this reporting. There are a lot of different kinds of ad hoc reports shot by employees to address certain specific issues, and rather than having those employees try to write up those reports and enter that kind of programming, this allows us to do that centrally.
If we repeal the weight mile tax and go to a fuel tax, is this area going to increase and additional personnel to go out and do auditing and discover the collection costs?
Mr. Chair, if you're referring to the fuel tax area, right now we're perceiving that there will be a shift. We're estimating there'll be some reduction. We've talked about a 16 FTE reduction in audit staff. However, there is going to be a shift in workload. And one of the things we're not sure about is how much enforcement issues there will be. We intend to work with, if this will pass, with the IRS to do the sampling of trucks and deal with the diet fuel regulation issue. We have gotten some horror stories from other states who are on borders of our nation who perceive that there's a significant chance of bootlegging operations coming into the state, in our case, over the beaches. We're not sure what the magnitude of the reality of that is going to be. Montana certainly has a major problem with it coming across the border up there, and they have a lot more per citizen, a lot more, if you use the ratio of truck regulation personnel compared to the size of the state, there are a lot more in Montana than in other states because of that bootlegging issue. We'll have to work through that and see what the reality is if the bill does pass.
Okay, but this does not anticipate making any conversion.
Yeah, this is current law. We have not put anything in here that assumes any change in that audit.
Okay.
The third area, Mr. Chair, within this package is the human resources area, where we're using professional services to give us flexibility to handle peak workloads or special projects by contracting out training when we have a lot of new employees in or a lot of issues relating to a certain subject. This allows us to contract out for that kind of training and not hire employees on an ongoing basis when the need is not ongoing. The information systems component is the staff operations cost, not for the staff themselves, but for the cost to allow us to do the customer visits, training, replacement of technology that involves going from Salem to a site in the field, or if the employee is stationed in Bend to sites that may be outside of Bend, to go to various district offices and get the work done. The next component relates to what the chair asked about earlier, dealing with cost accounting, the total cost of ownership project, and the information technology asset management system relates to developing interfaces at ODOT relating to higher order computer systems and decreasing the need for administrative staff to maintain multiple systems, and allows us to provide the true product cost information so that we can do cost accounting and move to a direct charge for service. So this is a piece of us being able to have the detail with which to do cost accounting and to determine what our costs are for those customers and make a better connection so that the customer, when they're paying in, that rather than just an assessment back, they can see what the service that was done for them by the Central Services Division. And that's, in essence, doing a chargeback system replacement to make sure that there's an accurate way to assign the computing costs that relate to each individual division. The last portion there, Mr. Chair, is the architecture and standards component, which relates to restoring the ability to develop technical standards for ODOT. There is an executive order right now which exists, which directs the states or the state agencies ensure they have solid standards for their organizations and try to tie those in on a statewide basis. What this also does is to return to the standards within ODOT so we can support consistent costs instead of having complexity with different kinds of systems. And also the last piece, which is within the support services area, making sure that we can have a purchasing and contracting education program which reduces our risk from ORS 279 relating to competitive bidding issues and allows us to make sure that we get information out to our employees about what purchasing issues are and what concerns that exist around contracting and around the process of going through our competitive processes. Mr. Chair, that's the budget as you build from a zero base up. I just wanted to summarize a couple of things and be open to any questions you'd have. I think there are a few points that are all-encompassing from the discussion that we've had. One is that the complexity of the infrastructure drives our budget costs. We've got a lot of people involved in using these. We're a geographically dispersed unit. There are a lot of people in the field. We have a high degree of availability required for our information systems and other functions, and that we have citizens waiting at DMV and are trying to reduce their wait times and be efficient for their use of time. There's high demand for the systems we're talking about, and there are a large number of applications for the different kinds or ways to apply the kinds of things that we do, required by a range from engineers to analytical employees to customer service people who are working across the counter. Each one of those requires a different level of central services support. We're trying to meet all of those, and central services are trying to make sure that there's accountability both on ourselves and working with the employees, those customers within ODOT that we serve, as well as accountability on the part of that customer to make sure that they're making good decisions and have good information for their decisions, and that we improve that connection of having a fee for the service instead of an assessment that gets lost in the overall. We actually have to get towards a fee that they pay, that they get a service for. They recognize what that benefit is that comes back to them and can hold us accountable to meet what they demand of us.
As following up on that, some employers have a turnaround time schedule for their employees to follow. And to keep your employees engaged with the public,
are there certain requirements of a turnaround time? As an example, if I walk in today and applied for an access to a highway, is there a typical turnaround time that you can indicate to me that ODOT employees will engage my request and take some action upon it?
Mr. Chair, within the Central Services area, let me address that area first because that's the one I'm working most directly with. Yes, we're getting performance measures in each one of our areas. By June 30th, we will have those complete in terms of usable measures by each one of the units. We feel like the communication of that standard, as you say, so that the expectation of the person coming in to get the service is, and they can understand what the expectation should be, and the employee giving that service understands what it is, so there's a shared expectation about what should happen. Yes, we're seeking that. By June 30th, we'll have those kinds of standards. The second piece relating to the department as a whole, we're working on that, and by June 30th, we will have measures in each area. I can't commit right now that all those sources of data have all been integrated and are functioning well. I think we need to make sure that those sources are clear and efficient, but we will have the sources identified and the standards identified by June 30.
Okay. In your last one item here, or not the very last one, was the ISD package 6, and that it requires architecture and standards. That kind of bothers me. I have a lot of engineers over here at ODOT, and I can still remember a truck ramp that they built up on the 60 summit, and it was like they were trying to tattoo it to the side of the hill, and anybody that's been down there knew that it was a hill that easily gave way because of the geology of the area. They spent $750,000 to put in this emergency truck ramp, and it slid down the hill within a heartbeat of being completed. And then they turned around and come back and tried to rebuild it again because it was supposedly covered by federal funds, and they finally gave up because on the second and third attempts, it sloughed off. When an engineer or an architect is in a depth on a flat piece of paper, everything matches out. But in reality, when you go out on the job and see what is there, it doesn't match out. And so I appreciate your uniformity of architecture and engineering, but I would say that I would rather see you spend a little bit extra time taking it case by case so that you know that if you're going to put something out there, it's at least going to stay, instead of investing great sums of money to see it slip and slide away and then try to justify it by rebuilding it in the same geographic area. They finally gave up and put it on further down the hill. But the idea and the comments I get from constituents is, you know, any fourth grader could have told you that mountain is moving constantly geology-wise. And Fitzhugh Summit has the same geologic fault as the San Andreas Fault. It's the east-west configuration, not a north-south configuration. I don't know. It just bothers me that we're not planning better rather than drawing something on a piece of paper on a desk and say, here, this will fit on this circumstance of this situation. And I kind of wonder how many other places were doing similar type jobs.
Mr. Chair, it sort of reminds me actually of the situation where property was donated to the Oregon Health Sciences University, and on the map it looks like a really great place, and it is a great place. However, if you have been there, you see it's on some real high hills, and they didn't quite, when they saw that donation, they didn't realize the topography and just exactly how steep and everything.
And they've
been able to really do well with it, but the point is, sometimes when we look at a flat map.
and I'm not trying to be critical, but I think, gosh, there's got to be a better way of
monitoring what we're doing, because the public sees that, and then they say, and they want me to up my gas tax to pay for poor planning. And I'm just saying to you what the people are saying to me. They don't mind paying their fair share of taxes, but when they see that as a kind of yield, then they are reluctant to pay more taxes.
Mr. Chair, I'll look at the specific example you gave. I can say that I know we have field personnel who are doing this work, so it isn't like it's all being done from Salem. I don't know about the weather or right-of-way or other issues on this particular site, but I do want to make sure it's clear that when we're talking architecture and standards in terms of this particular package, that means information systems architecture, which means how the programs and software and hardware are characterized, how we develop them, and that we have standards that are consistent about how we build that software. So it's a term that's used not in terms of architecture, in terms of building buildings, but rather architecture of building software and hardware systems.
Okay, well, let me ask you this question, as long as you explain it that way. What happens on July or January 2nd if I go in the DMV office? Are you compliant?
Mr. Chair, we're hoping that January 2nd is a Sunday, as I recall.
And come on down.
We're planning on
what happens on January
3rd. We will be in on January 2nd confirming where it's at. We're very happy that we have the weekend to respond to that, just in case.
Okay.
On January 3rd, we hope that any little bubbles that may have occurred have been taken care of and we're ready to go into business. We know that on the critical systems we're addressing, we've done the tests that we think will protect those critical systems. We do have other systems, those support functions that are smaller programs where we haven't done the work on those yet. We hope to have those done by January 1st, but the critical pieces, we will have the test done and should be able to take business. However, as has been mentioned in a lot of the press and other media, there are potentials that things exist out there or areas where we're integrated in with other systems where the work may not have been done somewhere else, and it may bleed over into our work because it was not made Y2K ready in another area. So we cannot sit here and guarantee that everything will be perfect. We can guarantee that we've done the tests that we think will address it in the critical systems.
In other words, things will be functional, except for working on Sunday. Okay.
It may be in the wrong section, but your points were very valid about your truck ramp, and I think we've all run into them. And part of what I see, I mean, I don't know if Mike's ever heard the story others know that I have about my tunnel that went in to design with 30-some lights and came out with 100-some lights and its own power system that would have gone out in the first bad storm we had in the coast in winter. And it was just suddenly this horrendous project. And the regional engineer wanted to, or the district engineer, excuse me, wanted to ask for a federal waiver because some of the requirements were federal and the folks at Salem refused to do that. I think there needs to be, I mean, your local folks could have said, you know, that thing slides a lot. But they're not always listened to. There needs to be that. I have a belief that the folks in the middle are insulated, and they're given the responsibility to engineer correctly, and they know they're the ones on the line if that thing doesn't work and somebody's injured. But ultimately, we worked this out, but only because we had local people, and one man gave up his trip to Australia just to fight it out. And that's what it became, and ultimately it became a good project. But and as we shift back and forth, there's the engineering design piece still is controlled by the folks with the pieces of paper, and the input, there's a more of a regional design team now that has local input, but I think a lot of times they're still not considered full partners and still not given that, and that ODOT hesitates to ask for waivers for things even when that might be the answer. And in a time of declining revenues, if 30-some lights have done it for years, we probably don't need 100. We may need more than 34, but probably not, and not, you know, a separate electric system that I think, if I recall correctly, added something like $5,000 a month or something to the cost of if the
month-to-month costs of operating the tunnel. I mean, it just, in a lot of cases, I think we're still designing the Cadillac, and maybe we can't afford the Cadillac anymore. And I don't know about this. This wasn't even a Cadillac, maybe
no.
A Humvee.
It was somewhere between an auto wreck and a truck wreck. I'm not sure what its definition was, but that raised another question. You indicated a few moments ago that there was a line for employees to call in and give anonymously suggestions and everything. What is the utilization figure of that line?
Mr. Chair, I can get that for you.
Okay. And the next thing is that line published?
Yes.
Because a lot of the employees I've spoken to out in the field feel that their ideas and suggestions don't get up through the middle management. It's kind of screened out. In other words, I've had an example where I can talk to Grace Carnathan and she says, sounds good, we should do it. And go down to the local community and they say, sounds good, they should do it. And then somewhere between Medford and Roseburg at the district office, somebody doesn't get the same message and it's like a short circuit in the wiring. And the same message doesn't follow through. I have both ends of the wire, but it's missing in between somewhere. And I think employees feel very frustrated that their ideas and suggestions are not taken perhaps more seriously as they're able to. It's just like the merger deal down in Jackson County between ODOT and Jackson County Road Department. The employees, if given the chance, would have come up with their own ideas and suggestions for making it better, more efficient. And it was like it was being run from the top down rather than the bottom up. How would you make it work better out in the field? Because those are the people I have to work with the issues day in and day out.
Mr. Chair, you know, I agree with you so wholeheartedly because I have seen in other departments and divisions that when the employees that are actually doing the work on the ground have an opportunity and are rewarded for their ideas, it makes all the difference in the world. And if they're, I mean, I know that obviously there is an attempt to do that by having this suggestion line, but I have seen departments just absolutely turn around when from the top, that was the message. We want your suggestions. We want to look at how we could implement them. And every suggestion is given a look-see to see if it actually is cost-effective or more efficient or whatever. And if there's some kind of ignoring of that and nobody ever hears, no employee ever hears back about the suggestion that's been made, they don't waste their time anymore. They, you know, the morale just sort of goes low and they say, well, it doesn't matter anyway. You know, I've made, five suggestions and I have yet to hear from anybody about whether they thought it was good or not. So not only is it good to allow for those suggestions, the next thing is that there actually is somebody to look at it with very open eyes and talk to the other person, the suggester, about it. And if it is not a good idea, I mean, if for some reason it's not feasible to put that suggestion into action, that employee needs to be told and told why, so that they will continue to say, okay, well, you've given me a good enough reason to say why it isn't feasible, but I'm going to keep working to try to find some suggestions. That's how you keep it going. And I just say because I've seen it work, and they do. Most of the people that are actually working within that system at some level or another really know better than the ones that are behind the desk.
I agree. I think there's plenty of suggestions that come in that are not doable, but the employee deserves an answer. Because we can't do this because, or economically, it doesn't pay to do it this way because we used to do it this way, but this is the way we do it now. All they're looking for is a yes or no and an interface with somebody that's alive, not a recording, not the voicemail or anything else that they can relate to and say, well, I tried, but I'm going to look at it again and come up with another idea. Mm-hmm. Because that's, when you said this idea suggestion line, I'd like to see how much it's utilized, because you have 4,000 plus employees out there. I'd like to see how much it's being utilized, because the word I'm getting from some employees is not being utilized because of sheer frustration.
And Mr. Chair, one other thing is that really from on high, on top management, you should look at where suggestions have come from, where none of them have been accepted, because there may be some person that is just very autocratic and doesn't want to take those suggestions, and they sort of stand in the way. Now, that may be an outside chance, but all I'm saying is that you really have to look at all levels, and if there is a particular area maybe that isn't responding, and because it can work. It can really work well.
Mr. Chair, I certainly agree with the Senator's comments. All it takes is a few times of not answering that employee, and they won't come up with another suggestion. Just a brief comment. We have done some surveys to ask employees some questions relating to this subject, like, have you been able to influence team decisions? Have you been part of the decision-making process? And in the most recent survey, it is up to 72%. We still have a ways to go, but the majority of employees are feeling like they are having an impact about where things are going. And we do have within our packet of material that should be to the committee tomorrow answers to the questions from last week, which related to what is our Excellence Award Program, what do we do for SPOT Awards, how does it relate to Employee Suggestion Awards Program statewide. We'll have that for you tomorrow.
Sure. Representative Schrader.
Request for information, kind of following up on the line of questions that you've had. Within the region, each region, there must be a hierarchical way that decisions are made. Is it possible to get kind of a generic flow chart from the pavement guy who comes up with the idea, who he goes through the next one until you get up to, like, Grace, a generic one? And I don't want to see all the FTE that are doing projects, but this would be just the administrative end of things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, I will sure look and see
like your job or your area. That's the highway department.
Right, but looking at the highway division in particular,
yes,
is the question.
Yes.
So it looks at what happens in the field for maintenance or construction, and then how decisions come forward. And
guy comes up with, if I'm in a chair, guy comes up with an idea, or there's a need for a decision. That road crew guy goes to his boss. That guy goes to his boss. You know how the flow would go. Is that possible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, yes, I think so. The critical thing I want to emphasize in that, though, is that we are trying to push that decision down. So what this would characterize is when it requires coming to Salem.
That's correct.
This would be how the flow would
that
go.
Would be good.
But the vast majority of decisions we're trying to push out and make sure they are in the field.
Okay.
All right.
Mr. Chair, if there are any other questions about the zero base information, the TGM issue was an excellent for today.
Okay, transportation growth management.
Can I just make a comment?
Representative Schrader.
I really appreciate the job that Mr. Marsh has done on this. This is far superior to the previous zero base budgeting presentation that we got. He did, in my opinion, a great job. I actually feel like I've seen this agency or this division of the agency from the bottom up, and I appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for
your time.
Yeah. Mr. Greenleaf. Mr. Benner, do you need to make some comments too? Why don't you come up with Mr. Greenleaf and
you're looking at something? Are you a paper you're looking at, or
transportation growth management? I don't think they have handouts.
Mr. Chairman, we just have prepared a handout to take you through a couple of the key questions which the committee asked us to respond to.
Okay.
So it'll be our intent today to cover those areas and take you through this handout.
Thank you.
To respond to any other questions which the committee may have about that issue. My name is Craig Greenleaf. I'm Deputy Director for Transportation Development. And the questions which came up in the prior discussions about the Transportation Growth Management Program had to do with two main areas of inquiry. The first of them was the structure and the working relationship that exists between ODOT and the Department of Land Conservation and Development relative to the program's management. During the 1995 legislative session, a budget note was created which asked for the department to put together an advisory committee and an operations committee for the oversight of the program. That has been done, and in our response to the first question there, we've identified the membership of the advisory committee. It includes a number of different interests with respect to the program overall, and includes really a fairly diverse array of interests that we've been trying to work with in forming up a transportation growth management program, which has been responsive to the cross-cutting issues that exist between the two agencies and among the private interests that are involved in transportation growth management issues as well. So this structure, which is both described in our response to question one and is provided for you as an organization chart treatment as an attachment to this question, shows the working relationship and the FTE that work in the program and how they fit together. I don't know if there are specific questions about that working relationships issue or if you wish to hear from Mr. Benner about any of the interplay between the two agencies, but that's the basic structure that we have in place for the program management.
Representative Schrader.
I notice there's no rural interest on here, no Farm Bureau, and then just part of the team or whatever. It seems like that's a lot of our land mass, and I wonder what the rationale was there.
I don't know that anyone asked specifically for additional representation beyond the counties to represent the rural portions of the state. The most difficult questions have seemed to have mainly an urban focus, although the transportation growth management work, it does occur across the rural portions of the state as well. We certainly try and make sure that the broad interests are addressed in the program. We haven't heard any particular concerns arising out of the farm communities about the way the program has been put together or about program outcomes that have somehow disadvantaged or not properly treated a rural portion of the state.
Mr. Benner?
Dick Benner from the Department of Land Conservation and Development. If you look at the membership of the advisory committee, you see that Art Schlack is a member from AOC and Burton Weaves from Oregon Special Districts Association. Some of the issues that arise and are discussed at the subcommittee are the allocation of grant dollars to counties. And these two people, and in fact, I think they're both here, so they could, if you're interested, they could tell you how that discussion has gone, how the interests of rural property owners and counties in particular have been accommodated in the program. That's where I would say you would see that. For example, the breakdown between TPR monies to do transportation system plans between cities and counties. That's an item of discussion at the committee level.
Representative Schrader, were there any more questions? Okay. Craig, did you want to finish responding to the questions that were raised?
Well, we can head into the second question, if you like, and which was really around the dollars and the FTE associated with the program. The program's aims are really to provide grants both to special districts and to local government in support of this work,
Are these funds, Craig, taken out of T21 funds?
That's correct.
And are the grants made through joint effort, LCDC and ODOT, made of T21 funds?
That's correct.
To a city or county?
That's correct. They're based upon...
And their requirement that they spend it once they get it at the city or county level, that they spend it on the transportation growth management, or can they influx it into their budget and spend it otherwise?
Mr. Chairman, there are specific contracts that operate in at two levels. The first of them is that there's an intergovernmental agreement which is reached with the local government. And the second is a specific contract around the work program and products to be produced for that particular project. There are specific outcomes that are designed to achieve the transportation growth management relationship issues. They are aimed at trying to enhance the consideration of and aim towards solutions found for specific transportation issues. They are not flexible funds in the sense that they can just be applied generically to local government's planning work, for example. They are aimed around specific areas and activities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on your original first question, T21 dollars, are those T21 dollars that would be available to spend in other projects? Are they coming down? Are they specified that they have to go to this type of program? Otherwise, could these dollars be used in road building projects or other construction types?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Starr, they are monies that could be applied elsewhere within the system. It's our view that what we're trying to accomplish with these things, much like the committee's earlier discussion, is to specifically identify projects in areas where there is local support and where we can best leverage the outcome for those expenditures. That's part of why the program was built in the first place, so that we make sure that we're aiming toward the right projects and the right outcomes.
Just follow up, Mr.
Yes.
I guess I have two questions. What kind of dollar amount are we talking about from the state? And then are these kinds of programs, I understand, for local transportation system plans and those kinds of issues, those, the TUSP, are those state mandated programs that the local government has to you?
They are, Mr. Chairman and Representative Starr. The program overall is about $11 million in total, and there are examples that we provided to you about the specific kinds of projects that are supported through the program. The first and most fundamental piece of work that we do is the supportive transportation system plan, which is a piece of work that is required under the transportation planning rule and the Goal 12 work, which requires as a part of the Department of Land Conservation and Development.
And there it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When TGM first started, it was part of ODOT. It wasn't CLCD, and it was sort of a compact little group that I thought did some pretty good work in terms of transportation planning and those sorts of things. Let me give you a concrete example of where you lost me. When it went to DLCD as well and expanded and they did the grants, I just assumed it was all going okay. I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. But last year, there was a grant given to one of the cities in my district, and I thought it was kind of interesting because I didn't see much of a transportation connection to it, but okay. Actually, the grant didn't go directly to the city. The grant hired a consultant to work with the entities, and it was an attempt to keep the city's downtown vital, an important thing to do. And I think that what they were trying to achieve was wonderful. What I question is the funding. I watched it from the outside, but then I had an opportunity last summer to be at a meeting where one of your folks was giving a presentation on that particular grant and that project. And In the discussion, he used things like, Safeway is my client, which was, for me, a unique thing to hear from the DLCD planner. And he talked about citing a Safeway store in Salem. That was another grant, I assume. It wasn't the one I was listening to. And basically what they did was take the $10,000, hire a consultant to sit down with the corporate entity and try to figure out where they could put their grocery store. The transportation piece was there, and I just this weekend had an occasion to review this with the city council in the city, to read if they had located the store in one of these places and if there was an increase in people shopping there, and that was a pretty big if. And if they didn't do anything to the existing structures, then there might be an impact to transportation. So transportation was way down here. Keeping the downtown city vital and vibrant was an important piece, and keeping that particular entity in town, that corporate entity in town, was important. And they did have discussions about naming some of the streets after that corporate entity, and I guess you could call that transportation, but it didn't strike me as something that we had to be paying for out of T21 money. In short, it was a great project, but I believe the funding was wrong. And I've come to believe that the money ought to be back in transportation. We still need a transportation land use connection. We still have to do that planning. It's really important. But I'm not interested in hiring land use planners who think they have customers that are corporate and taking transportation money to site corporate structures and rename streets when the benefit to transportation is minimal. And it was just, I mean, it just sort of really struck me listening to that whole thing. I have talked with people who work with TGM within ODOT who agree that many of the projects are not what they ought to be. And so for me, Mr. Chair, I would much prefer to get it housed completely back within ODOT to work with DLCD. They've got a lot of the expertise. Mr. Greenlee's background, if I recall correctly, is planning, and he used to work for DLCD. It's not as though the folks in ODOT only do transportation and have no planning background. But I have a real concern about some of those grants that are being handed out in DLCD using transportation dollars and, I believe, getting minimal benefits for transportation, which is what our goal is here, is to make the two come together. So we don't create an albatross that doesn't work and overburdens our existing systems.
Mr. Benner, Mr. Chairman, please introduce. Before I say anything about the specifics of that project, let me see if I can explain how we see the importance of working, say, with major downtown grocery chains in helping them keep a downtown presence. If ODOT's trying to contain its costs on highway projects, for example, to the extent that people don't have to go very far in order to get essential services, that is, they don't have to get on the state highway, for example, to get the essential service, they can preserve capacity, and they may be able to postpone an investment for a while. If you think about the typical Oregon town, and Astoria might be described as one, it has a downtown area. It probably has one or more grocery stores downtown, depending upon its size. Those grocery stores are probably 40 years old, maybe older, and they tend to be fairly small. They tend to be 25,000 square feet. What's happening out in the suburbs or out on the edge of town, often on the state highway, is a much larger facility being built by a competitor, or maybe by the same chain, maybe a 45,000 square foot store. The tendency has been all across the country and in Oregon as well to want to expand those downtown stores so they can compete. And we're seeing now a resurgence across the state in downtowns. People have decided, a lot of them at least, they'd like to live downtown or close to downtown, so they really need to have a grocery store. Well, if it's impossible for that grocery store chain to expand its downtown store in order to compete with the people in the stores in the suburbs, they're going to leave the stores. It was our belief, that is a joint belief between ODOT and
DLCD, that if we learned about a major grocery retailer contemplating a store expansion, or maybe contemplating a giving up the store to go out to the suburbs, if they would let us know, and if they would let the local government know, we could begin to work together. And it might be that we could help them expand that downtown store. You know, sometimes there are obstacles that are written in the zoning codes that, that prevent it. Or there may be a transportation problem that has to be overcome. So the Astoria store was the first one of these that came along like this. And that caused us to begin to talk to management of not only Safeway, but Fred Meyer and a couple of the other chains. And we're working toward an agreement now where they would let local government know, like Salem, Albany, this is happening in a number of communities, and let us know if this kind of move is contemplated, and give us an opportunity to work with them as a team, with the local government, to see if there's something we can do to accommodate them. If you can think about, I was just talking to somebody in the Laurel Hood neighborhood in Portland. They have, what's that chain that just got bought out?
Rite Aid.
Kino's. Oh, Kino's just got bought out. There's a Kino's in Laurelhurst. Kino's is closed down. The Laurelhurst neighborhood, which is a big neighborhood, now has no grocery store nearby. So those folks who used to be able to walk, bike, or take a short auto trip to Kino's now are going to have to drive a considerable distance. And they're probably going to get on Interstate 84. They're going to get on the state highways in order to get there. If we can be successful keeping these stores alive downtown and competitive, I think there's a very direct link to transportation. It may appear to be indirect, but we see it as very direct.
I kind of disagree with you, but there were three alternatives, and one of them was right on the highway that you guys seriously considered and eventually ruled out. But there were three, any three of which could have been chosen, and the second one was right off the highway. So while the city wanted to keep it in downtown, that was not the thrust of what was looked at with the grant. I agree that we need the team, we need the funding, we need all of that to keep downtown vital. But I don't believe that the funding source is right that we're using to get there. And in this particular example, that wasn't where the consultant was going. It happened to be where he ended up, but that's not where, I mean, if you're going to offer an alternative on the highway, you're not trying to keep traffic on.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, to the issue, some of the issues. My name is Grace Hunnigan, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I apologize for being late. I was down the hall for another committee meeting. If I could direct your attention to Attachment 1 and Attachment 4. Attachment 1 is FTE, you see we're using folks that are out in the region in our program. The senator's issue, putting it back in ODOT camp versus working with DLCD, the transportation planning rule is a DLCD rule regarding transportation. We need some linkage. These are folks that are working with all, 200 plus cities and 36 counties. And having a structure of this kind is invaluable, and having a link to private industry up top overseeing the work is invaluable because they understand some of those linkages. I would hate to see I've heard that comment before that Senator Deuce made about the guy saying my client is Safeway. And well, I think it's good news that state government is looking outside and working with folks. To me, the client would have been the local community, Astoria. And so I think that remark was unfortunate, not inappropriate, and I think the employee was fairly new. But to extrapolate that to the total package, I think, it's a little bit questionable. And if you look at this, Attachment 4 are as a planning guideline, and it's always good to come back and see where the money actually was spent. So we may not have done that, but what we target is 50% of the money to the TSPs, the transportation system plans, which is where the rubber hits the road with the DLCD mandate to do local transportation system plans and ours. And I'll tell you what's good about these TSPs is the local government is trying to figure out what its life is going to look like over the next few years so it knows how to direct its decision making, and we're trying through the highway plan and through the corridor plans and through our work with local governments to figure out what our highway system needs to look like. And this is where they come together, is when the locals have to sit down and say, okay, well, here's our vision, right, ODOT? And we come in through their TSP and we say, people, how are people supposed to get from one side of you to the other side of you? Well, we kind of allocated to you a smaller highway. Well, wait a minute, and then we have to come in and fight for, say, more capacity through town, or that's where we start talking about bypasses or alternate routes and stuff like that. And so 50% of this $10 million that we have in here, as Representative Starr properly asked, is this money that could go on the road? Yes, it is, $10 million. So $5 million of it goes to this coordination with local government, trying to give them a little bit of money to come up with some of the state mandates that are there. And then $3 million goes to related transportation planning, and $2 million is 2%, okay, actually to this stuff. And I assume that what the Senator Dukes was talking about was the Astoria Gateway Plan. Senator, is that correct?
No, that was a different grant.
Quick response. If I could, just a minute. Where does the quick response come in? Which category? Okay.
My name is Natalie Rupert. The program is split into both grant and non-grant programs. And the grant programs are given to local governments specifically for work that they've identified through an application process that they would like to work on. The non-grant programs are available throughout the biennium for issues that have come up through the biennium. As they arise, this is a resource that local governments can tap into for dealing with a development that's coming to town that has transportation issues associated with the program. So it's part of that.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you. As I've observed this program, it's there because the needs and the requests are there from local government. And the real question I think you have on this committee is it worth $2 or $3 million, the amount that go into these areas, to have that ability to help local government when they've got something coming into town that is problematic, so that the transportation discussion takes place. They certainly don't, when a big developer comes to town and proposes something, they don't, for example, in smaller communities, have the resources to come forward. We've tried to isolate and identify so there's a specific program with people of expertise that are accustomed to working together that have it. And so the question is, can it go on the road? It's $5 million basically of this, some of this activity. But in my opinion, and I'm trying to get dollars on the road, and I've spent considerable amount of time inside ODOT trying to get us more efficient and effective, it's very helpful to have an identified pot of money with an identified group of people like the home builders, like the AOI, some of those guys that have those broader interests in mind, so there's a structure set up inside my organization to which we can direct those folks. Because for the most part, you're just, putting blacktop on the road, and the expertise doesn't lie in every ODOT employee to have that conversation. So really, I think it's a fairly confined program. It's a defined program, and we've asked for external guidance on the issuance of it.
Representative Patrick, I just got a question in regards to, I think that some of the transportation growth management stuff is very good. My only concern is we have a situation, Dick, I'm sure is aware of this issue in the Medford area in terms of trying to do our transportation, our plan, our long-term plan, and running up against the land use issues in terms of trying to create a beltway around the city for traffic, which I believe is in the long-term best interest, and then the plan being sent back to us there. And I'm just wondering, from ODOT's perspective and GSCD's perspective, in light of what we're trying to do for the long-term planning, what's been done to look at is any of the time and effort being spent to look at policies that exist to look at long-term planning? I mean, for our situation in Medford, my understanding is that we'd have to get
some kind of exception of GLCD rule to do the planning that we want to do for a long-range bypass around the city or beltway issue on some EFU land. Yet that's 20 years out into the future, and there's no way we can get the exception now because we're not exactly sure. And this is kind of guesswork at best, some of it. And so I'm just wondering, have you looked internally at your policies or creating those exceptions? And I know you've talked with John Eads in Medford and some other people, but I'm just wondering what's being done proactively internally so that cities and counties can meet and local districts can meet with these long-term planning issues.
I'll let Mr. Becker answer that, Mr. Chairman. To the Medford issue, what I think we've come across is the north-south. Medford has relied, because we've been there for so long, on the north-south route to be the interstate, and it acts as a local road, basically, or a local an arterial in town. And what, through the process, various discussions I've had with folks in Medford, yourself, others, we don't have a street network in there. We don't have, Medford hasn't grown up to develop its own connectors. And so we have, in the process now, walking through the local plans under development and ODOT trying to look at its interchanges, if you will. We're trying to put in place some connectors in parallel so we don't use the interstate highway system as the only north-south route in town. That's the kind of thing that this program is set up to figure out and see if there's some way to help. In addition, we've also proposed in our budget $20 or $30 million to come up with a local street network. I think $20 million for a local street network. To come up with a local street network to do that, just that, where the improvement ought to be made on the local system. It's a state highway system that benefits. And then comes the question, as we collect these, you know, the specific information on projects, are there broader policy issues that we need to discuss as a whole? And I think we're starting to get there. We've just gotten off the ground, really, in many ways. Dick, maybe you'd like to.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patrick, on the policy question, the first project to come along that raised that set of issues, what happens if a major transportation facility serving the metro area has to go outside the urban growth boundary, and how is that dealt with under the transportation planning rule, came up about 4 years ago, and it involved the West Side Bypass. How was that going to be dealt with under the transportation planning rule and the other goals? The result was a major amendment to the transportation planning rule. I sat through the negotiations on that. They went on, they were facilitated, and they went on for many months trying to figure out how to do this in a more efficient way. It was agonizing. I hope I don't have to go through one of those again anytime soon, but there was progress made, and there were amendments made to the transportation planning rule. Those amendments would apply, I think. I don't know that much about the Beltline that you're talking about, but I've heard you say that it would sweep outside the urban growth boundary, probably come back in at some point, but at least part of its course would be outside. And that was the same issue that came up on the West Side Bypass. How can we know where the highway is going to go if it's 20 years off? And one result was language that would allow the siting of a corridor, even though the precise location of the highway would not be known until specific planning were done a long ways ahead. And that was the way that issue was resolved. It would take an exception because it is an urban highway in a rural area outside the urban growth boundary. But we did spend time addressing that and trying to figure out how to make it more efficient.
Just a question of clarification. But do we have an ongoing, are we proactively, rather than having a Medford, for example, say, boy, we sent up this, we worked hard on this plan and now we got it sent back. Instead of working it that way, being reactionary, are we doing anything to be proactive from DLCD's perspective or ODOT's perspective in terms of trying to do some clarification, education, trying to maybe survey city planners and people like that to know what kinds of issues they're having to deal with? It's great to have rules and everything else, but what I felt like we were forced to do in the Medford situation was, even though that's what our plan is, we just moved it from a first tier and a second tier program and then kind of the amorphous kind of issue. And so we pushed it in the third tier so it wouldn't bounce so it wouldn't bounce outside the program. And what I'm saying is, if we want to do these and put our best foot forward and be very forthright in our planning process, are we doing anything from within your departments to be proactive to the cities and those types of things? I work with Grace a lot on some other stuff, but I haven't worked really with DLCD that much. So that's all I'm asking.
One quick thing, Mr. Chairman, Senator Petridge. When the regional transportation plan was reviewed and we found flaws in it and asked that those be addressed, that established a dialogue, and you may remember it. There was criticism of our department because we had not been present at every meeting as the transportation plan had been developed, and some people were surprised by some of our comments and wished they had been made earlier. One of our responses to that, and I think there was some fairness in that posture, we now have a full-time person in the field down there, Jeff Griffin. You may have met him or attended meetings with him, so that we don't have that kind of delay or break in communication. And I think if we had had that person in place, say, a year before the region adopted the regional transportation plan, we probably would have been better off. And part of our response as well was to, we now send a transportation person from the TGM program down to those meetings, and you've probably seen him down there as well, Eric Jacobson. So there have been some system responses to what you described.
I guess I'm not asking, but to me that's kind of a reactionary thing. If we're looking at, all the, I was trying to look at like attachment 4, and I assume that many of these are your transportation for people who haven't had their plans adopted. I imagine your related transportation planning efforts. And I mean, I imagine there's lots of jurisdictions across the state of Oregon who haven't had the check mark in the box and their plans approved. And I guess what I'm asking is, have we done anything with those groups saying, you're in the middle of this or you're just starting this? Are we, are there some policies that you have concerns about? Are there those kinds of issues that you have concerns about, to be proactive so that we can react to those rather than having a plan sent back? Does that make sense? I'm not criticizing your department for not attending meetings or anything like that. I didn't even know about that. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patrick, just from where I sit, the best thing that we've got going for us, the answer I think is we haven't got a process underway right now to review what's going on there. We're sort of gathering. It's unfortunate maybe for you that you were sort of the first kid in the first group. As an old child, I can appreciate that parents are a little bit more understanding. First of all, come the last child, it's been my experience. But in terms of first person through the process or up there, I think that the more we can, Dick really did touch on it. No, we haven't revised it enough so that we're on the third kid yet, so to speak. But the best thing we've got going for us is when they get someone at the table as early as possible. And I think the other best thing we've got going for us is by having this structure in place where transportation and DLCD are at the table at the same time, the reality and the practicality is setting in real fast. And so by having a conversation there, we might want to, just build the darn street and kind of ram it through. And there may be more of a policy orientation on the part of DLCD to start in terms of process. But by the time we all sit down at the table and walk through what's there, we get a lot of help out of those guys trying to figure out the why of it. And there's a good conversation that takes place. It feels a little, rough when something has to be put forward and then rejected and then we go back again, and it's a pain in the neck. I appreciate that. And I would say we haven't gone and done a revision of things yet, but what's working better and better is the fact that we are talking, and so we've got people that understand both sets of problems at this point kind of early enough in the space. So the key is to continue to inject them early enough in the process, which is what a lot of this is about in the first place.
Yeah. I just heard that a lot of the criticism, I think, is the level of the DLCD and and ODOT both in terms of some of the CGM kind of stuff that's been dealing with some of the policy issues. And so I would encourage you to, you know, as you move forward, to look at those. And I think you're doing those to some extent in some areas, but I think that there needs to be some kind of a substantial effort to look at some of those kinds of policies. One, so you're not criticizing. It didn't take a lot of heat, but two, I think it makes it easier. Coming from a city government, I think it makes it easier. So, you know, and I appreciate what's been done. I know that your department's been talking with the city of Medford and other and Jackson County in terms of some of these issues. So I certainly appreciate that. He's been open to those kinds of things. And I think we're working on a solution. But, you know, that I would encourage you to be proactive.
Okay. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I think that if we're going to have land use policy driven from the state level and we're going to have transportation policy driven from the state level, that we provide the adequate resources to local levels to accomplish those state mandates. And I think that my experience and my city with this CGM program is important for the local governments to build accomplish the state mandates.
Does the record show that Mr. Art Schleich from the county association head has not stopped bobbing since he made the statement? If there's no other information to come before us, we are adjourned until 8 o'clock tomorrow. We'd like to finish this up tomorrow and be in work session Thursday and Friday. Wednesday, we're going to have housing, state parks, and try to speak up to the main bills of the committee. So we'll see you all at 8 a.m. in the morning. And that's it.